Sarah Rudolph, director of the theater program at the University of Wisconsin Marathon, tells us, two anecdotes come to mind when discussing mental illness and performance. Most acting students know the story of Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman working together on the 1989 film Marathon Man. Learning the lengths to which his co-star went, including depriving himself of sleep, to feel vulnerable for a particularly difficult scene, Olivier commented to Hoffman, "My dear boy, why don't you try acting?" Around the same time, a University of Wisconsin theater student performed in the improvisation comedy troupe Comedy Sports, where success relied on creating a rapid-fire series of distinct characters defined by exaggerated eccentricities, nervous tics, bizarre vocal expressions, clumsiness, and socially unacceptable behaviors. By day, this theater student worked at a state mental hospital. At night, he struggled with the extent to which his troupe's improvisations involved stereotyping the kind of patients entrusted to his care. The method acting approach taken by Dustin Hoffman implies that within each of us there exist extremes and possibilities that enable us to identify with a range of human experiences. Olivier's rejoinder to Hoffman implies that a skilled actor need only create a convincing guise to represent experience that already exists. The Comedy Sports anecdote suggests how performance might actually reinforce social constructs of mental illness and marginalized existence. Sarah Rudolph is particularly interested in theatrical performance that challenges assumptions about mental illness, and she turns to the basic belief that narrative helps shape our sense of self and other, and that stories are key in both life and theater. She says the power of narratives and their attendant imagery to shape a person's consciousness compels us not only to consider the stories we share and those told about us, but also to recognize those who are complicit in marginalizing individuals from various groups, including those with mental illness, through the stories they tell. Disability arts have opened the public's eyes to the challenges of living day to day with various conditions, while respecting the authority of those who have first-hand experience with such challenges. All this from the essay, Whose Mind Is It Anyway? Acting and Mental Illness, by Sarah Rudolph, in a study titled Isolated Acts, edited by Harpin and Foster. There is a significant project at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, just outside Wilkes-Barre, that is rooted in the power of theater to tell stories and to serve as a catalyst to, in the words of Harpin and Foster, investigate health and social problems, to help us understand how others experience things, and to envision a wider range of possibilities when approaching others, and to help in finding solutions to some of our most pressing problems. Dr. Alicia Nordstrom, professor in the Department of Psychology at Misericordia, has, as well, extensive experience in the world of theater, and she has brought those two disciplines together in the Voices Project, working with Dr. Amanda Caleb, Associate Professor of English, on the fourth chapter in this series, The Voices Project, Mental Health. The theatrical production will be presented April 20th through the 23rd in the Le Mans Theater on the Misericordia campus, and the public is invited to attend free of charge. Dr. Nordstrom paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about The Voices Project and its history.
It started in 2009 as a psychology professor at Misericordia University. I teach intro to psychology every semester, and I have a part of the class where I talk about stereotypes and prejudice with students as part of our understanding of social psychology. So how we think about other people, how our brain makes judgments of other people, and how that affects us. And I have a part in the class where students, I ask them to report on different stereotypes of different groups, like women and men, different racial groups, religious groups. And I had a student who very seriously said in class that when she was on a plane, she perceived that there was someone that was a Muslim person that was a terrorist. And she ran off the plane and she called her mom and she was really scared and very upset by this situation. And so I thought to myself, one thing that we're here to do in college is not just teach the content of our areas, but to teach students how to be the best professionals they can be in their career. And I pictured this student who was in the health professions, you know, go into a waiting room and seeing a client that maybe she perceives as Muslim and making an interpretation. And so here in the workplace is a great example of how our attitudes could actually really help or hinder, you know, what we're trying to do, particularly when we work with other people. So in that moment, I thought to myself, well, I'm an educator. I have a classroom. I need to really think about how to help college students begin to look at their attitudes, particularly towards groups that they might not know a lot about, that they might have some stereotypes about, and help them really examine those stereotypes and say, well, this is what my brain thinks, but how accurate is this perception? And I really thought that I could do it through having students do research, and I had done those assignments before, go research this group, what are the stereotypes? But even more powerful, I thought, was to enable students to create a relationship with someone that they might have a negative attitude about. And so the whole concept of the Voices Project was to use what we call contact theory in social psychology, which is putting people in direct contact with someone that's very different than you or even from an antagonistic group, actually has been shown to reduce stereotypes and prejudice across the globe in lots of different cultures and has a strong basis of 50 years of research. So that was kind of the concept. In 2009, I had three different sections of intro to psychology students. I had my very typical class that does a little term paper, and then I had a class that did a little research assignment, and then I had the Voices Project class. And so those students were 30 students, and unbeknownst to them, I did ask them to rank different social groups in society, and they gave me the information about what groups they had the most positive and negative attitudes about, what groups they knew the least and most about. And I assigned each student to interview someone from a group that they knew the least about or had a negative attitude about. So there was some anxiety. There was actually a lot of anxiety. Students were a little worried, like, wait, I'm interviewing who? Like this person? And so we talked about it in class. I helped them prepare. I taught them interview strategies, how to deal with different situations. And the students went out and they met their interviewees. And when they came back to class, they looked at me and said, Dr. Nordstrom, that was just like a regular person. And I said, yeah, it totally was. It happened to be someone that was Muslim or someone that had obesity or someone that was in poverty, but still a person. And so through that interview, they were really able to see beyond the label or the category, get to know the real identity of that person. And then the students became the champion of their interviewee. And so the students wrote memoirs, 5 to 7 page memoirs of the person they interviewed, as if the student was the person, assuming their identity for the purpose of this assignment. So then I had these 30 incredible stories from these 30 individuals who volunteered to share their experiences. And I commissioned a team of faculty at Misericordia, and we took the 30 stories and we excerpted them and created a staged reading program. So at the end of the semester, we performed or we read out the stories to an audience of 300 people at Misericordia. So I got a lot of positive feedback of people saying, oh my God, I couldn't believe that amazing story of the woman that was homeless and how that happened to her. And so people were saying, are you going to do this again? So in 2011, I did it again on physical disability. So that was not a group that was included in the original project. So I partnered with the Center for Independent Living in Scranton, who in 2 minutes got me 15 volunteers who were ready to talk about their experiences having different physical conditions. So that included deafness, blindness, spinal cord injury, stroke, cerebral palsy. So a whole range of different conditions. And once again, my students interviewed their person, they wrote a memoir, we integrated them into the program that we call the Voices Project Disability. And Misericordia was kind enough to let us video record here at WVIA. So on my website, we actually have the 52-minute documentary that aired on WVIA, which is so exciting because it lives on. You know, it's something we could still show to our students and share with other people. So here we are now, and I have been waiting for this topic for many, many years. My background is in clinical psychology, and so we have the Voices Project Mental Health. And I thought that it really needed its own space, just like physical disability needed its own space, that they're two different experiences. So this past fall, I was fortunate enough to partner with Dr. Amanda Caleb, who is one of our English faculty, And we put our classes together and we had 50 students interview people with a variety of mental health conditions or people that have family members with the conditions. And I'm going to read off the conditions because there is many, many different things that we've captured. So we have anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, Tourette syndrome, Alzheimer's and dementia, intellectual disability, autism, substance abuse, eating disorders, alcoholism, suicide, PTSD, and dyslexia. So I used as my criteria, because some people say, well, how did you decide? You know, is Tourette syndrome really a mental health condition? Is dyslexia a mental health condition? And my thinking is that if it's in the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that psychologists use to diagnose a mental health disorder, then it was fair game for this program. And part of what I hope to accomplish with this project that we've done is to really ask a lot of questions about mental health. So I think it's great to ask, what does it mean to have a mental health condition? So Tourette's syndrome is a neurological condition. So what makes it a mental health condition? Some of the parents of kids with autism that were interviewed, their stories reflect the concept that my child thinks differently, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a quote unquote disability. It's just a, you know, a different way of thinking and maybe a way of thinking we should even appreciate. So there's a range of experiences that were captured by these students. And these students, most of whom were first year students who just arrived at Misericordia, were so mature and embraced this project with such a personal investment and a feeling that it was more than a class assignment, that I am now in charge of capturing this person's story, which is why we call it the Voices Project, to capture the voices of people who are invisible or misunderstood or stigmatized. And so the students really felt responsible. Like they were the owners and the gatekeepers of these stories. And so they really put themselves into these memoirs that they created. And some of the stories were incredibly painful. So there's people who shared stories about sexual abuse. There's veterans that have been through really challenging, life-changing situations. And then there's people who have lost spouses to Alzheimer's. That is such a common but very painful situation for spouses, for children with loved ones with Alzheimer's or dementia. So we have those experiences. We also have experiences of parents who just absolutely adore the uniqueness of their children, whether it's autism spectrum disorder or intellectual disability. And then we have a really interesting group of mental health conditions that most people don't even think about. So a lot of the stereotypes that we're challenging in this project are those that represent what we think mental illness looks like. So we think it's someone that's ambling around on the street. We think that it's linked to people who are dangerous or criminals. We think that it's people who are so emotionally unstable that they can't hold jobs. And a lot of the pictures of these stories are extremely successful people. So people who have high administrative jobs, people who are lawyers and teachers and doctors, and they're hiding it. So they're the people that you have no idea what the internal struggle is, because it's kind of like a double whammy. They have this condition, but they're so aware of the stereotype that they also need to hide it and to keep it secret. And so they're not getting the kind of emotional daily support and validation that they need and that they deserve. And to me, that is the damage of the stigma and the stereotypes.
You could have stopped and had the stories in writing and compiled them into a book or something like that. But why is it important for us to hear these voices, literally?
Yeah, I appreciate that comment and that question, because what started out as a classroom assignment to benefit the learning of my students, I've added in two other audiences that I'm trying to reach. So I have my students who are doing these interviews, and I actually did research on how this project impacted my students' attitudes in the very, very first version. And I did find that it actually reduced racism. So for the students who interviewed people from different racial groups, those students showed reductions in racism compared to students who didn't do the Voices Project. So that was exciting for me to see that the learning goals I had, it was addressing those. So that was really exciting. But I also began to have this responsibility to the interviewees. So here is a group of people from the community who are opening up their experiences to these students that they've never met, that are essentially strangers. And for some of the people, they've never told their story to anyone. That's particularly true of the mental health version. I had students who interviewed people that have never, it was the first time that they're actually sharing this really, really personal, intimate story. And so as I'm meeting all of these interviewees and I'm realizing the need for them to be heard, I now feel a commitment to them as well. And so I think that's really important, that part of the service. And I think that for me, being housed in a university like Misericordia University, where we have such a strong mission, you know, the sisters have such a history of speaking for underrepresented and ignored groups, that is very consistent, you know, with the mission at our school. And so I have now the students trying to reach them. I now have these interviewees who are opening themselves up, sharing their stories. So I want to bring them validation. And I think that that next level of going from the classroom to the staged reading, and now actually in the mental health version, that in just a few weeks, starting on April 20th, we are doing a full-out theatrical production. So for the first time in its history, it's not just a staged reading. It is over 22 actors from ages 9 years old to 70 years old. And they're just unbelievable, this group of actors. And they range from Hazleton to north of Scranton. And they are so committed also. So the students are committed to sharing these stories accurately. And I know that this set of actors will work tremendously hard to represent as accurately as possible the experiences that they will be communicating. And I feel like the third group that is really important here too is the audience. So for some people that come to this program, they're really excited because they know about mental health. They have anxiety or depression. They have a parent with Alzheimer's. They are connected into these topics. And for them, I want this to provide validation. I want them to feel, oh my God, someone else gets it. I know exactly what that's like. When the parents with autism stand up there and share their stories, the parents with autism in the auditorium will say, oh my God, that's so true of my kid. Or, wow, that's so different than me. So I think connecting into both the similarities and the differences is really key to actually breaking a stereotype, because it sends the message, there's no one way that someone experiences an eating disorder. So in the program, we have three different people and they have certain things that are similar and certain things that are different. So for the audience to be able to, one, feel connected to other people that have gone through this, but also for people who don't know anything about mental health, for them to be able to have an experience where they get accurate information that's not just processed by other people or something, you know, you see in the movies. So they're hearing stories from real people. And we put on the flyer, find out what you don't know about mental health, because that's really the goal, is to come and to listen. And for someone who doesn't know a lot about maybe schizophrenia, you know, most of us probably don't know someone that really has it. So to come to this program and be able to now have a picture in your mind of what that looks like that you could take forward with you to get an accurate representation. So over time, I guess the project in my mind has a different purpose depending on who's connected to it.
How was the script created for this theatrical presentation?
That's a great question, because in the past, I've probably had about 25 stories maximum. And in this situation, I have over 60 stories. And I wasn't sure how difficult it would be to find people with mental health conditions that are really willing to openly share their experiences. I really just didn't know. And so I was aiming for maybe 25 people, and I'd have two students interviewing one person, and that will get me my, you know, for the 50 students. And so it was kind of slow at the beginning. Some groups were easy to find, some groups were hard to find. I was so grateful for our local NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we have a Wilkes-Barre agency, we have a Scranton agency, a Tunkhannock agency. They are a wonderful, they're really a support group for people or family members that have mental illness. So they helped me find some people for this project. And I did do some reach out for social media. Even at Misericordia, I put out a message. And a lot of people from Misericordia came out to share their stories as well. So that's just to say that integrating 60 stories into a theatrical program is a challenge in terms of time, because we want everyone to be heard. But we need to have, you know, some fairness to make sure everyone does get heard in that space. And I'm aiming for an hour and a half. We're not going to have an intermission. We want there to be inertia and flow in the program. And so we're trying to keep it, you know, short enough. But fortunately, I have this amazing writing team at Misericordia. Becky Steinberger from English. She has been such a key partner for me. Amanda Caleb, who's in English. Patrick Hamilton from our English department. Alan Austin from our history department. Melissa Scroy from our communications department. Molly Vitale from Teacher Education, and Matt Hinton, who runs our Writing Center as well, and our Student Success Center. And I have a recent graduate, actually, before she goes on to a master's program in England, Taylor Rupp, joined us as well. And everyone has really helped me craft this and integrate this into a cohesive program. And so some of the scenes are by condition. So, for example, there's a scene of bipolar disorder with five individuals that have it, from college students to adults. But we also have a scene called Caregivers, and that actually crosses across conditions. So we have in that scene a man that has a brother with schizophrenia and a woman that has a mother with schizophrenia who are the caregivers to their siblings or their parent. And then in there, we also have two daughters with a mother that have Alzheimer's going back and forth with their two different experiences. We also have two mothers, one mother with postpartum depression and one mother with two teenage sons with Tourette syndrome, going back and forth of two different parenting experiences. So we tried to do both, where we highlighted certain disorders and how they present similarly or differently across people. But we also wanted to pull out themes that are themes that unite and cut across conditions as well. So that was kind of our approach. We gave a lot of thought to order, and I would kind of see it like a little wave that we're going to really try and balance out the pieces that are more emotionally weighty in terms of the content. And I did mention on the flyer as well that we don't recommend it for young children, because particularly for the PTSD scene, also suicide is one of our topics. We have four stunning monologues of four people who lost individuals to suicide. We have a son that lost a mother that lost a son, and two siblings who lost siblings. And I think that suicide is something that makes people really uncomfortable. For people that have lost someone to suicide, people are not likely to really approach them, to even give them the opportunity to talk about it. So I think that that is such a great need in terms of some human connection, you know, with that topic. But we recognize that in the world of mental health, there's the emotionally difficult moments. There's also some inspirational moments. Some people who say, I went through a really rough time, but it's made me who I am, and I wouldn't change myself for the world. And then we have some people that just have a great sense of humor and are really funny and have a great joy of life. So even though they have some kind of diagnosed mental health condition, they still love life and have a wonderful personality as well. So it's all in there. It's all going to be in there. And I think that my hope is that by the end of coming to this theatrical program, that people will just feel a sense of human connection, that they have experienced something deep and something meaningful, that they've entered into the most intimate personal moments of the lives of the people that share their stories. And I hope it will always be a part of them, that they'll always carry that with them.
Dr. Alicia Nordstrom, professor of psychology at Misericordia University and creator of The Voices Project, speaking with us about The Voices Project Mental Illness, a collaboration with Dr. Amanda Caleb, associate professor of English at Misericordia. The full theatrical production will be presented Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, April 20th, 21st, and 22nd at 8 o'clock each night, and again Sunday, April 23rd at 3 in the afternoon in Le Monde Theater on the Misericordia campus in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre. The public is invited to attend free of charge. For more information, on the web, misericordia.edu, MISERICORDIA, misericordia.edu. Misericordia University, presenting The Voices Project Mental Health, April 20th, 21st, and 22nd at 8 o'clock each night, and again Sunday, April 23rd at 3 in the afternoon in Le Monde Theater in Walsh Hall on the Misericordia campus in Dallas. The presentations are free and open to the public, bringing together a research project and public theatrical presentation designed to promote the understanding and to reduce the stigma of mental illnesses. For more information, on the web, misericordia.edu, misericordia.edu.